This is Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
Each episode, we explore the human dimensions of climate change with some of the leading experts at the University of Colorado and beyond.
I'm Jake Fox.
I'm Cameron Nicewander. We're your hosts for the show.
It is our goal to help you, our listeners, learn about the health consequences of global warming.
And ask you to get involved in personal and political efforts to slow climate change.
As always, please check out our webpage, cuconsortium.org/podcast, for episode summaries, show notes, and our comment box.
Without further ado, on to the show.
And this long line of cars is all because of you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Attention Humans. Today, we are excited to sit down with Dr. Chris Karnauskas. Dr. Karnauskas earned his PhD in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences from the University of Maryland, College Park, followed by a postdoctoral fellowship in Ocean and Climate Physics at Columbia University. He is currently a fellow of the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences, an associate professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder, and a member of the CU Consortium for Climate Change and Health. Dr. Karnauskas, first question, did we miss anything important in your biography?
Actually, you did. I have two kids, and that's a pretty dominant part of my life right now. So I'm proud husband and father of two little ones.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that addition, and thanks for being here with us today in your fancy laboratory.
My pleasure.
So, Dr. Karnauskas, first question we like to ask to kick things off is, how much trouble are we in?
Good question. You know, I think that all depends on what we do in the next 10 or 20 years. You know, if we do nothing but sort of continue acting like nothing's happening, or we're not the central cause of it, then, you know, my kids and theirs will be left with a very different planet with a much hotter, more volatile environment than what we were handed. And on the other hand, if world leaders start to actually pay attention to the overwhelming scientific evidence that describes, attributes, and predicts the profound impacts of climate change, then I think there's a chance that the answer to that question might be only a little bit.
That's a fantastic overview. I think that there's a lot of issues that we want to talk about as they relate to climate and health. But in order to do that, we feel like we might need to talk a little bit about the science, which is kind of why we've come to you today.
Great.
So can we start off, can you just define what is climate change?
What is climate change? Well, I think that's going to depend on the context. You know, we have a whole branch of climate science that's looking at how the climate system has varied before humans, you know, had an appreciable impact on it, and that's called paleoclimate. So climate change writ large really means changes on all time scales, you know, from one winter being warmer than the next to, you know, the long-term changes that we're seeing over the past 100 years that we have some idea who's behind that. And then the perfectly natural changes that have brought the Earth in and out of the ice age cycles over hundreds of thousands of years. So, you know, climate change can have a very broad definition, and I suspect you guys are here to talk to me about, as we drill down to one aspect of climate change that's been going on in the past 100 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. So I make sure I understand your answer correctly, climate change, we can define this in terms of hundreds of thousands of years cycles, and then as well as this variability in between seasons, for example.
Right. So climate change, you know, unqualified, that, you know, just to be inclusive, that can mean things that are natural, and that can mean things that are caused by humans or volcanoes erupting, the sun's power varying over time. You know, so climate change can be occurring on all different time scales, and it takes a lot of work to figure out, you know, what's causing what. And that definitely depends on, you know, the sort of time scales you're looking at.
Absolutely. So we want to talk to you today about this anthropogenic climate change, anthropogenic meaning human caused. I did want to clarify one point before we jump into that, and that is the difference between weather and climate, because I think Cam and I hear those words used interchangeably sometimes, and I think that's incorrect, but we thought we'd ask the expert.
Sure. Well, you know, I think if I were to pose to a classroom full of students here at CU Boulder, what's the difference between weather and climate? I think a lot of times the answer I might get is sort of geared at thinking about averaging, you know, like the climate is the average weather. And there's some truth to that. Certainly we define our current climate as a long-term average, you know, maybe a couple of decades where we average out weekly weather cycles and things like that. But I like to think of climate as a much more rich, dynamic sort of beast rather than just something that you average, you know. So the climate system on Earth is really characterized by the way that the ocean and atmosphere, the ice, the land surface, and people and other parts of other ecosystems on Earth interact with one another. So there are actually processes, physical things that go on that are really part of climate, and they're quite distinct from weather. And they certainly play back and forth with each other. But, you know, I do like to think of climate as much more interesting than just the average weather.
Interesting. Yeah, so when a senator throws a snowball on the floor of the chamber, or Trump yep. tweets out something, it's not correct.
Right, so it's pretty well known that if you're going to testify before Congress about climate change, you're guaranteed to get a cold snap on that day.
I've heard people try to make this distinction between climate and weather and sort of relate it back to humans. And I think as future physicians, this speaks to us. And so I've heard this analogy that maybe you can help me unpack a little bit. But essentially that climate is the personality of somebody, is the underlying personality, whereas weather is more reflective of their mood at that moment.
That is a great analogy. It's one that I haven't heard, and if you don't mind, I might use it in my own teaching, but I think that's a great analogy. You know, someone who recently passed away, unfortunately, was a real luminary and a leading giant in our field named Wally Broecker from Columbia University, and he's credited with coining the thermohaline circulation and the conveyor belt and some of these really big concepts in climate science. And one of my favorite quotes from him, and I'm going to try to get this right just off the cuff, but I think he said, climate is like an angry beast and we're poking at it with sticks. So I think, you know, this notion of personifying the climate system is probably okay when you're thinking about it in terms of long-term versus short-term cycles. It's a temperamental thing with a personality that can change over time. And, you know, you could be a generally very happy person but have a really bad day and be down in the dumps that day and vice versa. So I actually really like the analogy.
I think, you know, along with the volatility of weather, how can we exist in weather every day but then take a step back and know that our climate is changing?
I think that's really hard for us to do. We're so wrapped up in our own world, our own day-to-day. We notice much more easily things like, it's unseasonably cold for early April in Colorado or something like that. Or, you know, at the tail end of a winter, you might look back and say, wow, it's been a really snowy winter. It may not even be true if you actually look at the data. But, you know, we're not that good at having a long-term memory. We just kind of feel what's around us. We have a short memory. So, you know, I think that's natural, to be expected. Sometimes it gets used, you know, in ways that are, you know, trying to twist things around. But I think that's where, you know, you have to be patient with science. You have to gather the data and look at it objectively. And you might be surprised to see an underlying trend that you never even knew was there. There are places in the world where the natural variability is really small. Like think about, you know, where we are now, Colorado versus a place like Florida. Here we have seasons that are drastically different. And in Florida, South Florida or somewhere else in the tropics, the difference between summer and winter isn't as much. And, you know, every day is fairly similar. It's warm, it's humid, there's a chance of some rainfall popping in the afternoon. You know, in a place like that, you're probably going to notice the trend a little bit more easily, right? If you're used to something more consistent, here in Colorado, where we've got lots of weather variability, or up in the Midwest where I'm from, it's going to be hard to detect a trend. And I don't think that's something we need to be too hard on ourselves for, but that's what long-term observations are for, gathering data carefully and keeping good records.
Awesome. No, thanks for kind of walking us through that variability, that volatility. If it's okay with you, I'd like to go more big picture. So we mentioned early on that there is this natural variability in our climate, you know, over hundreds of thousands of years. So how do we know the climate is changing now? And I'm referring to this human-caused climate change, in addition to that variability we've seen in the glacial records.
So I don't think it's controversial to say that the climate is changing now. I think you're hitting on the point where the real meat is at, which is how do we know it's us? But there's really no question that the climate is changing. Even even when debates flare up about climate change, it's usually not about that. It's about why is this happening and how much of a role are humans having. But, you know, over the surface of the Earth, over the past couple hundred years, we've had a growing network of, you know, thermometers. And they're not everywhere as we would like them to be, but we have enough confidence to put pretty small error bars on how much the Earth's temperature has changed since the, say, 1800s.
How are we able to look at these data that we've collected in terms of temperature or emissions and really zero in on the effect that humans are having? In essence, how do we know that it's us?
Well, we know that we are the principal cause of the ongoing climate change for a few reasons. And a couple of them are, I would say, easy for anyone to wrap their mind around, but less scientifically rigorous. So let's walk through the simpler ones first. You know, so for example, CO2 is going up. That's another thing that's just not controversial. No one can argue with a good head on their shoulders that carbon dioxide on Earth has been going up since 1948. It's been going up for longer than that, but we've had a pristine record of carbon, of very careful chemical measurements on Mauna Loa every day throughout the day, and we can see it going up, you know, without a doubt. There's almost no natural variability in it except for the seasonal cycle. Okay, so carbon dioxide is going up. At the same time, temperature is going up. And as future doctors, you probably are very appreciative of the need to resist reading too much into correlation in terms of causation. So climate scientists are not walking around, shaking each other's hands because there's a correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature. We have to go way further than that to really establish this, the causation of it. So carbon dioxide is going up. The greenhouse effect, the physics of the greenhouse effect tells us that the Earth's temperature has to go up if greenhouse gases are being added to the atmosphere. We can talk more about that later if you want. But so it really comes down to figuring out why the CO2 is going up. And believe it or not, there is argument in the world about that, not so much within the scientific community, but we do, kind of like lawyers, we have to get all of the facts, establish one thing causes the next, and that causes the next, and so on. So there are actually ways that we have to look at some carbon dioxide and detect whether it came from burning of fossil fuels or some other natural source. And it's actually not that complicated, as I maybe alluded to it. So fossil fuels are actually buried plant matter, right? That's what the fossils really are. It's plants that used to be alive, photosynthesizing, which is drawing down CO2 and giving out oxygen. So in that process, the plant scientists have figured out that when plants photosynthesize, when they do their breathing, they prefer a certain isotope of carbon dioxide. There's different isotopes of carbon dioxide.
And an isotope is just like a different type of carbon atom.
It's so much simpler than the fancy word implies. An isotope is really just an atom with a different number of neutrons. So an atom is what it is because of the electrons and protons. But if you just throw in an extra neutron, it's still that same atom. It's still carbon in this case. It's just got it's a heavier carbon because it's got an extra neutron in it. So there's a few of these carbon isotopes on Earth, and there's a couple that are especially relevant for climate. And so when we look at carbon dioxide, we can actually detect whether it's got the heavier or lighter isotope of carbon in it. And that lets us figure out if it came from burning us, you know, digging up, essentially is what we're doing, digging up these buried plants that used to be photosynthesizing and emitting their carbon into the atmosphere. So we can tell if it came from, you know, human emitted greenhouse or fossil fuel burning versus it was just there or it came from some other source.
This is the so-called, like, carbon fingerprinting?
Yeah, you could call it that.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, from that, we can tell that it is when that isotopic ratio started changing was about the time of the Industrial Revolution. So it's really clear. It just kind of jumps right off the page when you look at the data that that's when this started changing and that's when the carbon dioxide started going up. So it's like bulletproof case that the carbon dioxide is going up because of fossil fuels. And unless there's some other aliens or species on Earth that are also emitting fossil fuels aside from us, it's definitely us that are doing that. And then the laws of physics take over from there and say you're adding more greenhouse gases in, you're letting less heat get out. So first law of thermodynamics, temperature has to go up.
When we talk about carbon dioxide and methane is a big one we hear about as well in terms of being greenhouse gases. You mentioned that those trap heat. How does that process happen and how does that contribute to an increased global temperature?
Sure. So, you know, the sort of first level view of understanding the greenhouse effect is thinking of it like an actual greenhouse. And it's not a bad analogy. It's why it's called the greenhouse effect. So if you have a greenhouse, what's going on inside of there is that the sun's radiation makes it through the glass no problem. It gets right through. And to some extent, that's how the Earth's atmosphere works, except for where clouds reflect it. And some other things in the atmosphere can absorb it, like ozone. But we can consider the atmosphere pretty much transparent to solar radiation. So it gets right on through and it warms things up, warms up the surface. So the next place that energy goes is it's going to get emitted by the Earth's surface as a different kind of radiation. It's no longer solar radiation because it's not coming from the sun. It's just heat. It's, you know, there's a bunch of words we could apply to it, thermal radiation or infrared radiation. It's all just heat energy. So that is trying to escape. That's what the Earth is emitting back to space. And greenhouse gases are, you know, they're molecules that are constructed in such a way that they are really good at absorbing that heat that's trying to leave and then re-emitting it back to the Earth's surface. So prior to humans coming along, there was a nice balance between that kept the temperature of the Earth on average at a certain state. We're not changing the solar radiation. We're not changing much else. We're changing the amount of greenhouse gases that are there to absorb the heat trying to leave. So it's fairly straightforward that then the temperature would go up if more heat is staying in the planet instead of making it back out. We can actually quantify how much that is in, you know, in terms of real energy units using satellites that are orbiting the Earth right now. We can detect this imbalance of energy and quantify it and see if it squares with the expected change in temperature with what's really going on with thermometer records. So
we wanted to follow up on that. So a lot of the climate reports that we hear about in the news, like the IPCC report or the National Climate Assessment, they're based on some of these models, right?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of look at how much heat is being trapped. And they also project it into the future. So I wanted to kind of follow up on that and ask you how those actually work. And
climate models.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, is this a bunch of voodoo science or?
Yeah, climate models play a really central role in those types of reports you mentioned, like the IPCC and National Climate Assessment and other things. You know, they're tools that have been developed by the scientific community over decades now. that were really built for this purpose. They're built for understanding how the Earth's overall climate system responds when we hit it with some kind of external forcing, like throwing in some extra greenhouse gases. So what they really are computer programs. A really important distinction that is a big source of confusion I notice all the time. These are not collections of data sets. They are actually just the equations that are like the laws of physics that we, you know, you could look up in a physics textbook, and they are simply coded into computer language. So that's what they are. They solve all of these equations that that describe how the wind moves, how temperature goes up and down in the ocean and the atmosphere, and how it all works together. So the reason that climate models are these sort of enigmatic things that are inaccessible to most folks is that, you know, they take a lot of horsepower to run. You need huge, you know, room-sized computers in most cases to do these big experiments that go into the IPCC report. And that's because the world is pretty big, and the way that climate models are applied to the world is that we partition the whole planet into a bunch of pixels, kind of like a TV screen. So there's a whole bunch of pixels, and each one of those pixels represents some space on the planet. And all of those equations I just alluded to, they have to get solved inside of each one of those pixels. So it takes a lot of computer power. This is not something that you can do in Excel or, you know, with a pencil and paper. These are pretty sophisticated computer models of the climate system. And we run them in the past, we run them in the future to understand what might happen in the future as, you know, given different assumptions about our emissions of greenhouse gases. So it's a lot of data that this these kinds of models kick out, and it, you know, it's that's why it's fairly inaccessible and enigmatic, as we can't just sort of share them with everybody and have them run and use it. It, you know, it takes some pretty big computers to do this.
Right. Can't run this in my MacBook at home.
I mean, you can. You might just, you'll be retiring before you have the simulation that's done harsh. With. But, you know, they're computer simulations. And as I said, a really important distinction is that they're not being fed the data that we have, the real observational data that we have from the real world, because we're trying to, you know, see if they can confirm those data instead of, you know, having that be baked in.
So is that how we know they're accurate or reliable?
That's a big part of it. Okay. Yeah. So if, you know, you want to make a prediction of the future, it's an obvious thing you're going to want to do first is see if the model was good at reproducing the past now that you already know what happened. It doesn't guarantee that your future prediction will be perfect, but it certainly can confirm to you that there's some validity and skill to this computer model you're using.
Hey, everyone. With that, we're going to close out this episode, although this is certainly not the end of our conversation with Dr. Karnauskas. Instead, we're going to divide this climate science primer into three episodes. This is a really important subject to be able to understand the health and climate connections in future episodes, so we want to deliver it to you in bite-sized chunks. So please join us for further conversation with Dr. Karnauskas in the next episode, where we'll talk about uncertainty and CO2. See you then.
You've been listening to Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
We unpack the human health dimensions of climate change and emphasize the urgent need for all of us to get involved.
We want to thank Dr. Rosemary Rochford and Dr. C.C. Sorensen for their mentorship on this project.
Ellen McFarlane and Matt Cook for technical support.
Cake for the jam and theme music.
Our awesome guests for sharing their expertise.
And you, our listeners, for paying attention.
See you next time.